On this episode of Still Loading.
Out of my face. You're blocking my view. Shut up. Stop talking. Just go the hell away. All the world needs is me. I got my values. So you can keep yours, all right? I don't get people. Never have, never will.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this new episode of the Still Loading Podcast. I'm your host, Josh Koval, and today on the show, we are discussing a very good RPG game, something that it took me a long time to beat, and I beat for the first time, I want to say, last year. It is a game by Square Enix, or published by Square Enix, excuse me. But as usual, I have a guest on the show. You know, I can't talk about these games by myself. That'd be boring. So with me today is Mike from the YouTube channel Forever Loading. Mike, how are you doing today?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm doing very well. Thank you so much for setting aside some time for this. For those who do remember Mike, he was on the episode The Wonderful World, or The World of Working Designs. I was going to say The Wonderful World of Disney. It's a very different thing. He was on the episode The World of Working Designs, which was a deep dive into the game publisher, the game localizer and publisher of Working Designs. So if you haven't checked that out, go back about a year ago or so and check out that episode, because Working Designs did some cool stuff. But I invited Mike back on here because he is one of the biggest fans that I know of The World Ends With You. So Mike, to start this whole thing off, what got you into The World Ends With You? How did you first discover the game, and when did you first play it?
Well, I first discovered this game basically through Kingdom Hearts, because the creator, the graphic designer, character designer did Kingdom Hearts 1 and 2, and my best friend at the time was the biggest Kingdom Hearts fan I've ever met, and she said, there's an action RPG coming out for the DS by the same people, by some of the same team of the Chain of Memories. We've got to play it. And then she basically decided, that's what we're going to do, and you're going to do it with me. And I played it, and I beat it before her, and the rest is history.
Was she mad at you for beating it before her?
No, I don't think so. I think she was just surprised.
Fair enough. For me, I first discovered it because my best friend, Justin, who was the original co-host of the show, for those who've been listening for a while, he first got it because he had a DS before I did. And I remember him being like, dude, this game is so cool. Look at you fight on two screens at the same time. This is crazy. And I was kind of like, okay, it seems interesting. But I've always had a very hipsterish mentality with, like, if someone shows me something, I'm like, yeah, I'll get to it. I'm sure it's really cool. Yeah. And in my mind, I'm like, it is cool, but I don't care enough. I'm not going to touch it. But This game actually stood out a little bit. I was pleasantly, I remember at first I was kind of like, it seems interesting. But then when I watched him play it, I was fascinated by the gameplay. And then I bought a copy of it, which I'm glad, because the game is hard to find on the DS now. I think it is, right? It's pretty hard to find a DS copy of it.
Yeah.
At least for an affordable price.
It went like in and out of production, if I remember correctly. Like, it didn't get a huge first print run. They didn't expect it to sell well. Then it did, and they're like, oh crap, we got to print more of these. But it never was like a mega hit for Square or the DS.
So there was actually an interview IGN did with some of the developers of the game, and I believe it was the director, one of the directors, Tatsuya Kondo. Their first point of their first, like, not really question, but statement was, they say, first of all, congratulations for this on the success of The World Ends With You. Oh my God, I can't speak. On the success of The World Ends With You in both Japan and the States here. The game surpassed our expectations sales-wise and went on to become IGN DS game of the year. And that's when he was saying, Kondo replies and goes, thank you very much. We're very, very happy about the warm reception that the game has received in North America, despite the fact that it was set in a location based in Shibuya, Japan, which that was a real thing. That was actually a concern in development. Early on in development, they were considering having it be like multiple cities, so it would appeal to more countries. And they're also considering it into, once they pared it down to one location, they weren't sure which city to choose. Obviously, they went with Shibuya, but that was, even that wasn't guaranteed because they were nervous that people outside of Japan wouldn't be able to connect with it as much. But I actually think that's what gives it a little bit of charm, that it's not like something that I'm familiar with. What about you?
I agree. I remember hearing something like that too when they were first releasing the game. They were uneasy about how it would do because it was just one part of one city in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
But Shibuya in The World Ends With You is such a rich, varied place, and there's so much to see and do, and there's so much to the city that it's like a character in of itself. So I think you can't really do The World Ends. I can't separate it from the game. It's a very important part of the game.
I feel like that's like a really strong sign of how good that this game is. Like, it really holds up surprisingly well. And I beat this for the first time about a year ago or so. And I really think a large part of the reason it still holds up is the fact that the setting is just so strong. Like, it, like the aesthetic, the whole visual aesthetic, the setting, the locations, the characters, like the characters are very anime and very like mid 2000s anime. So that kind of hit me a little bit in the nostalgia sweet spot. But even so, like the visuals still look really good. And then the world they build is super fascinating. Like it basically is like, what if Tetsuya Nomura, who, once again, that's who you're mentioning, he's the guy who is like the creative designer for Kingdom Hearts and the lead for Kingdom Hearts. What if he got to be all Tetsuya Nomura, but slightly less, and not ruin the story every single time? That's what it kind of feels like. But then again, actually, he usually does a really good job with the first game in the series and keeping it in a condensed story. It's usually after that where he tries to retcon everything.
That's true. That's fair.
I've done an episode on Kingdom Hearts 1 and 2. I really need to do an episode on the other ones because, oh man, those stories
are wild. That.
I know. A friend of the show, Eric from the Unlockables podcast, he is starting like a little side project podcast type of thing where I don't know if it's going to be on his Unlockables feed or if it's going to be something that he like starts a separate feed for. I'm going to have to find it again, but he's basically doing like a Kingdom Hearts, podcast all on it. It's going to be, I forget what he's calling it. He did a really good job of an intro. He made this whole intro. Oh, it's called Guiding Keys, the story of Kingdom Hearts. So he's doing a whole, and I think it's going to be on his podcast feed. So I'm very excited because he loves that series and he's a good podcaster and I'm excited to hear what he says. Anyway, I digress. That is neither here nor there. We are talking about The World Ends With You. So some other bits about the game's development. It was originally envisioned as a kind of like a interesting port of Kingdom Hearts Chain of Memories. There, when they first saw the DS hardware, the developers, they thought like, well, what if we took Kingdom Hearts Chain of Memories and the action role-playing segments can be on the top screen and the card battle game that is actually the mechanic of Chain of Memories will be on the bottom screen. And obviously that did not stay. They ended up with what it was now, but that was where it originally started at. Eventually, once they kind of switched gears, they kind of designed the game around the fact that they wanted to be a game that could only be played on the DS. Like, when you play this game, it fits perfectly for the DS. And I would argue the DS is the best way to play this. This has been ported to mobile and also the Switch. What are your thoughts, though, on the ports of these games?
I have to agree 100%. It just fits the DS hardware 100 perfectly. It obviously was tailor-made for that system.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like the mobile ports and at least the touch control version of the Switch ports aren't bad, but they lose a whole dynamic when you remove the dual screen aspect of the game. And it's some people find it more manageable, but I feel like it loses a little bit of its touch when you take that away.
And like the dual screen aspect isn't that hard to manage. Like they really make it that you only have to truly focus on one screen. And if you really want to, you can just keep hitting the right directional button on the D-pad over and over and over and over again. Like you don't need to really keep track of both screens. I mean, if you can, if you're really good. I'm not good enough to keep track of both screens at all. Did you ever get good at mastering the dual screen combat?
Yeah. Going back to a friend made me play this. I think she said it best, is like, you have to be a little ADHD to be excellent at this game. And I am very ADHD, so I'm pretty good at this game.
This is the game for ADHD heads. ADHD or ADHDers. Is there a term for people with ADHD? Like a clinical term? No. All right, we're gonna get off that. I don't want to offend anyone.
But you have to kind of divide your attention. That's true. But if you leave the character alone for just a second, the autoplay will pick up. So you're not really at risk for ignoring them for just a second. It'll kind of pick up for you after a while. You can change that setting to do that.
They design around it. I think that's really smart. People argue for it now with a lot of the Souls games, you know, like accessibility options. Like, do you want to play it slightly harder? Then your characters will do nothing. You have to control them all the way. Like, it's a nice accessibility option that they add in there for sure. For the kind of overall design of it, they kind of, the team decided to keep it with two-dimensional sprites instead of three-dimensional models, mainly just to help them stand out from the rest of what Square Enix was putting out at the time. The noise, which are the monsters that you fight in this game, were actually based off of real animals. They wanted to kind of make it something somewhat recognizable, so that way when you defeat them and they turn into skeletons, you had some semblance of an idea of what they were. Designing the sprites for the noise, they had to design them in from several different angles so that way it would match the action on screen. And apparently also used some rotoscoping on pre-rendered sprites, which is kind of crazy to think that they're still using rotoscoping this far in. Like, rotoscoping, I feel like, was something used in like the 90s.
So rotoscoping has been around forever. It's a really old technique. So yeah, that's interesting.
But like, I mean, specifically in games, like you never really saw it often in games. Rotoscoping, you would see very often in animation, but not necessarily as much in games, I feel like.
That's true. That's true.
I mean, that's why you ever see those, like, I don't know if it's memes or like reels of on like whether it's Instagram or like TikTok or something, where you'll see two different Disney cartoon scenes and the animation's exactly the same, but they're from two different movies.
Yeah,
it's called rotoscoped. You know, they just drew over the same like stock footage that they used as the basis of it, which I find kind of funny. Full disclosure, I did not have a lot of time to do as much research on the development of this game as I wanted to. And I really feel like I did a bit of a disservice. So maybe as a bonus episode, like solo, I'll come back and just kind of throw a whole bunch of like development details in at once. But I think what's important to note is the thing about this game, dear listeners, is that it takes place in Japan. It is one of the most... it's got an extremely strong aesthetic of this modern, very Japanese, very modern, very like fashionable, like Japanese fashion, of course, but like it's really kind of going for what was popular at the time. Like the music is very like, the music's actually really good in this game. Like
it's really good.
The whole aesthetic though is super strong, and I think this is a game that the Tetsuya Nomura art style really benefits from. I think Kingdom Hearts sometimes suffers a little bit from it. It gets a little bit too insane. You know, when Sora has like pockets that have pockets inside of pockets or something like that. This kind of works because it is 2D. So it's got that anime aesthetic. What do you think though?
I agree. I think Because the whole aspect is like youth culture, fashion, modern pop stuff and punk stuff and even gothic elitist stuff makes its way in there sometimes. It's all about like what will be popular on the hippest parts of the streets in that city in Japan. So it works in that sense. And also, like you said, the 2D anime art style really is a benefit for this type of graphic design.
I definitely agree. So let's kind of dive into the game and the gameplay and the story and the music and the artwork and all this good stuff. Now, a spoiler alert, there's going to be spoilers. I mean, I guess it's kind of redundant to say that in that sentence. Spoiler alert, there's spoilers. We're going to spoil the hell out of this game. This game honestly does plot twists pretty well. What do you,
I would agree with that? It does a good job of tricking you to think you're, I've done it at least like 3 or 4 times. So it's constantly throwing new stuff at you, but in a good way.
Sometimes plot twists like that can feel contrived, and it never feels like that in this game. I actually think the plot twists work really well throughout the course of this game. The basic overall premise, and this is kind of tying into what I said before, where the aesthetic is really strong. Like the world building in this game is really fucking good. Mike, how would you describe what this world is like? Because there's just to kind of give a basis for you to jump off of, the world is split up into 2 different parallel worlds, and you do find out that there's more than 2, but for all intents and purposes in this game, there's 2 parallel universes. There is the underground, and then there is the RG, which is the real ground. How would you describe these 2 to people?
I describe it kind of like a background layer and like a cellophane cell layer, like an animation reference. Like the real ground is the real world, but there's another thin layer over it or under it, rather, that exists that kind of can coexist but not be known to the main layer. Like a background layer, yeah.
It very much feels like the underground is like a ghost world that, you know, is parallel to the real world. You know, like they exist and they can see the real world, but they don't really interact with the real world. Mm-hmm. That's kind of like what the vibe of it is. So the overall story, you play as a character named Neku Sakuraba. I hope I said it somewhat okay. Sakuraba. He is a teenage boy who, quote unquote, doesn't get people. That's an understatement. He is one of the most antisocial. Like, he is like Squall from Final Fantasy VIII levels of emo, but on steroids.
Yeah, I'd say that's fair.
He's so cranky all the time. He's just a cranky boy. Wakes up in, like, he's walking through where does the game start? Like, which section of Shibuya do you remember?
The shuffle, the crosswalk area.
Yes. Starts off in the shuffle.
By the big tower, the shopping center.
That's what it is. So Neku's walking around, and like, that's actually where you hear the intro quote that you heard for the beginning of this episode, with Neku just kind of yelling at people, like telling them to stop talking. And it's because no one can hear him. It turns out Neku is dead, and that's how he got into this world. And he gets a mysterious, I think it's a text message. He gets a mysterious text message talking about being part of this thing called the Reaper's Game, and that he has 60 minutes to get to the, the 1040 building?
Yeah, the 104 building or 109 building. Yeah.
That's what it is, to get to the 104 building. And Neku kind of understandably is like, what is this? Like, what are you talking? Like, what's going on? Like, I don't have to do this.
And then all of a sudden, spam.
Yeah, he thinks it's spam, right?
Yeah.
And then he gets a timer, like painfully, like almost like etched into his hand. It looks pretty gnarly. Like, it doesn't look like blood or anything like that.
It's like a tattoo.
Yeah. It's like he suddenly got tattooed, but the tattoo actually moves and animates and stuff like that. And that's the timer that he has. That's how he knows how much time he has left. So he has to get to the 104 building before the time runs out in 60 minutes. And or face erasure, and it just assigned the Reapers. That is an amazing way to start the game off with just enough information that you understand you're in some sort of a game. Whoever the Reapers are, they seem to run the game. And you have 60, you have clear rules and guidelines. I have 60 minutes to get to this building. And that's that. You don't really know. How, I wonder, have you ever tried like just waiting for 60 minutes and not get to the building?
No, I haven't. That's an interesting idea, though.
I wonder, I doubt they would. It's an RPG, because a lot of times like time is stationary unless you see an active timer or something like that. But that'd be kind of cool.
They kind of lock you into meeting the first inciting incident of the story pretty quickly.
I mean, you could just, but what if you just chilled in the shuffle and just didn't move? You know, just left your DS on, waited an hour.
That's an interesting idea for sure.
I kind of am curious to see what would happen if they did that. So from there, you know, you kind of learn a little bit more about what the Reapers are, but it takes a little bit, but you do learn about, like, as the game progresses, you learn about what the Reapers are, but at that moment you have no idea. And you meet a character named Shiki, who is kind of like your best friend throughout the game. I don't think you would classify her as a romantic interest, right?
Not exactly. I would say she's more like a best friend. Yeah, someone who he really cares about, but I never really get the feeling that they're romantically involved throughout the game, or those feelings there that way.
Yeah, I agree. I don't think there's anything there either. After meeting Shiki, what happens next? Like, what's going on with the story?
So basically, he runs into this girl who screams, "You got to make a pact with me. We got to get together. We've got to do this." He has no idea what's going on, but he accepts.
Mm-hmm.
And by doing so, you're allowed into combat for the game, where you have Shiki on the top screen and Neko on the bottom, and they're both coexisting, fighting their way to this 104 building. And they realize that part of their task is to get to the 104 building. They have to have a partner, and Neko has to trust his partner. And when he gets there, he meets other characters who are in the game. Some of them make it, some of them don't. Actually, a lot of the characters in the game disappear pretty quickly.
Yep.
They get erased. Yeah, they get erased from existence. No one knows who they are anymore. And Shiki kind of becomes a driving force for Neko to come out of his shell and to engage more with the world and the characters. And secondary characters, Beat and Rhyme, show up. They're also in the game. They're like a brother-sister pair, and she drives them to work together, and she kind of drives the plot forward a lot. And even though Neko doesn't trust her, he doesn't like her at first, he doesn't want any social or human interaction, really, and he almost tries to kill her pretty quickly into the story before being stopped by not Deus Ex Machina kind of character, but kind of a watchdog character for the story. And that was incites him to keep moving forward and learn more and let the world and the story envelop.
And I feel like I remember, like, cause that whole thing about how he does, like, Neko is a loner that you're mentioning before, how he doesn't want to interact with Shiki. He hates pretty much everybody in the game. I really think they did a good job of not making that whiny. That could have been really whiny, and it was whiny for a while, but like the character actually changes.
He grows throughout
the course of the game. He does. And a lot of times, like, I should say a lot of times, like sometimes you have a character like that where they learn a lesson at the end, but you don't actually get to see them apply the lesson.
Yeah.
Type of thing. It's usually like, you know, you beat the final boss and it's like, oh, maybe this wasn't so bad after all, type of thing.
Or you don't really believe they learned a thing either.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But this one, he learns his lesson. He learns lessons as the game goes on fairly quickly. And by the end of the, to kind of explain a little bit more of like what this game is, and you didn't explain any of the game, did you? You just kind of explained.
No, I just basically talked about Shiki, but the point of the game is these people on the underground, the ghost layer of Shibuya, are fighting for a chance to come back to life. There's can be one, or they think there can be a pair of winners, but in reality, there's one winner. And at the game, they get their life back and they get to resume their life. And they never died at all. And they're all fighting for that. And the Reapers give them little menial or sometimes challenging tasks to go through the day to eliminate players in this challenge. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's get to this building. Sometimes it's fight these creatures. Sometimes it's find this MacGuffin. But it's all tied to that. And Neku goes through this game not just once with Shiki, but three times with a different partner each time. And each week he goes through this game, he grows a lot. And the game kind of unravels and grows a lot with him. There's a lot of changes to the game, especially in the second and third week.
Yeah, because after the first week, like, so you're with Shiki for the whole first week. And the way that people get into these games in the first place, like, they have to die. So Neku gets killed. Shiki got killed. Did Shiki commit suicide?
It's vague. I don't think so.
I am blanking on it.
I think they say it, they leave it vague, but I think in the anime, at least they made an anime out of this last year, or the year before. Mm-hmm. They say it was an accident. So I'm not sure if it's the same in the game or not.
Okay. I couldn't remember. I just remember Shiki was basically when you die, you have to, in order to participate in the Reaper's game, which is what this whole thing is.
Yeah.
You have to give something up. You have to give up something that's most valuable to you. So it really puts everyone, besides just fighting for their own lives, it's also fighting to come back to life. It's also fighting for something else on top of that. The reason why Neku doesn't know anything in the beginning, doesn't, like, why does everyone else know about the Reaper's game except for him? Like, Shiki knows exactly what's going on. So does Beat and Rhyme. Like, they all know what exactly is going on. So why doesn't Neku, and it fits with this character. Like, this is a bullshit plot, but I think this works really well. His most valuable thing to him was his memories. And that fits for the character because Neku was a selfish piece. Oh my God. Neku was a selfish piece of shit. So
he was, and it fits his character perfectly. Like you said,
exactly. So who, if
he
someone
values
who's
himself
selfish,
most of all, he values exactly. his experiences, and that's what they take away from him.
And it's probably one of the best written ways of having your character have amnesia that I've ever seen in any media. Like, take gaming out of it. It's a really good story reason for your character to not remember everything. And it's very refreshing because most times it's like, oh, they got hit on the head.
Yeah, it's a very earned story beat. The game, it earns that convenience for the story by having it fit his character.
I agree. And you were saying before how we were talking about how Neku grows throughout the course of this game. And it's true. Like, by the end of the game, he's a completely different person. But his first biggest amount of growth is by the end of the first week. Like, he grows a lot at the end of the first week because by the end of it, he actually likes Shiki. He hates Shiki in the beginning, but as he kind of grows to get to know her, because you find out, like, what Shiki actually gives up is it's her appearance, I want to say.
It's her image, yeah.
It's her image. The Shiki that you see throughout the game is actually like her best friend. Like, it's the body of her best friend who she
worked with.
Coveted. Yeah.
She did. Like, Shiki was a seamstress and a sewer, and she made all the outfits that her friend designed. And she thought she would never be as good as her friend or as pretty as her friend. And she never thought she would equal to her friend. But you learn through Shiki's week of the game that her friend is equally lost without Shiki to bring her creations to life. And that gives Shiki a new perspective on herself. And she realizes that's why she treasures her image. It's because it's what she is. She is who she is.
Exactly. And that's, I like how each character has like that. Like, they really, like, every character grows, but it's really fun to see Neku grow. Cause realistically he's got the most character flaws out of all of them. Well, I shouldn't say the most. He's got the one they focus on the most. I guess
he's got the most evident ones.
Yeah, exactly. Yes, that's a better way to put it. It's not that he has the most character flaws or the worst character flaws. It's the most noticeable, that's for certain. Mm-hmm. I forget what Beats is. Do you remember what Beats is? Beats and Rhymes were?
Beats and Rhymes are kind of the same. Beat and Rhyme are brother and sister, but they don't. Rhyme doesn't realize it because her entry fee was her memory of her brother, because they were both really close. And Beat's most precious thing was his relationship with his sister. And by robbing her memories of her of them being related, it robs him of his relationship with his sister.
Oh my god. And that's really fucking tough. Good writing. It's like what's that story about the husband and wife who want to get something for each other for Christmas.
The husband loves
to play harmonica, and the wife likes to, I don't know, paint. So the husband sells his harmonica to get his wife like an easel, and the wife sells all her paints so that way she can get him like a nice harmonica case or whatever. That's not the exact thing, but you know, I forget what the term of that story type, but it feels kind of like that, but in a much sadder sense. Like they lose both of it. It's nuts.
And with each partner, each round of the game, the story evolves and throws a lot of twists at you, I think. Like with Shiki and Neku in that first round of the game, the first week, it all follows a pretty stable skeleton of a plot formula. It's not creative. It's very creative and it's very well done, but it kind of follows what you'd expect to some degree. And then in the second week with Joshua as your partner, they throw a lot of what you've learned out the window, and you have to reestablish your whole understanding of the world, the rules, the characters, and the motivations from the ground up. So they do a really good job of, with each new character, not just does Neko have to grow and understand new things, the player gets to grow and understand new things with a new perspective and a new lens to view the game world and to play the game in a certain way too. So it always keeps it fresh with each round of the game, each week of the game in the game.
And they, one of the things that you kind of get hints of along the whole way is like the way the Reapers game actually works behind the scenes. Like it's not even like they keep the Reapers game a mystery the whole time. You kind of understand the hierarchy of it. So you find out that there's a composer who, a conductor. There's the conductor who runs the Reaper game. And then you find out above the conductor is the producer, who is kind of like the mid-tier boss, if that makes sense. But there's also the composer, and
the composer's like the god of the game.
But the producer can also affect what the composer mm-hmm. does in some way, shape, or form. It's interesting. It's like, because I was reading, like, some people theorize that the producer is at a similar level to the composer, because if you think about this, it's all in terms of music, right? Mm-hmm. Producers and composers do similar things. Like producers produce beats usually, you know, like they lay underlying tracks for musicians to write their music. But composers, it's more writing intensive from my understanding. Like producers, you still do a little bit of, like, you still write music, but it's still different. It's like it's more of a business-based type of thing. So I wonder if that's kind of like why they're kind of similar in terms of power, but like the composer,
they both have power, but their power comes from different places and they have different directions.
Exactly.
Their power is aimed. Yeah.
I think that's better way to put it. They're both incredibly powerful, but the power comes from different places. So you have the conductor who runs the Reaper game, who sets the rules for each sets the objectives for each of the 7 days and sets the rules and regulations of the players for mm-hmm. those 7 days. Then you have the producer, like we said, producer and composer can interact with the game world, but they usually don't. Reapers are interesting because they're kind of like the soldiers of this weird organization thing.
They're like the footmen of the army.
Yeah. Do they ever say like what they, like, this organization is? Like, is there even ever a name for what the composer, producer, conductor is? I don't think there is. I don't remember.
I'm not sure if it's in the secret reports you can collect throughout all the levels or not. I haven't gotten all the secret reports since like 2008. There's a lot to find out too, but it's basically like they create Shibuya. They create that region of the world, that region of city. It's their space, is the composer's space. So they have the power to see how it rules and how they do it how they see fit. And they can the whole reason they play the game so many times in the story is that the composer wants to get rid of Shibuya. He wants to wipe it and start over. He feels like it's gone too far. People are too cynical. People are evil. People are ruining the city. He wants to wipe it off and have a clean slate. And that's why these games are going on for this specific round of games, the Reapers games. So the composer has a lot of power, but they make it pretty clear that in most of the Reapers games in this universe, they don't really interact with people. They interact with the higher generals or the producers and stuff, but they don't really interact with the players much. So when that does happen in the game of The World Ends With You, it's pretty alarming to the other NPCs in that department.
I wonder if this is a allegory for like Christianity in a sense, or the belief of a God, because that's kind of like how, like I've said before, I'm fairly religious, but like I don't really like shove it down people's throats. I don't even bring it up often on the show, but it's kind of like how a lot of Christians view God, where it's like, I shouldn't say it's like he can direct people to interact with the world, but it's a very like it's hands off, but at the same time, there's influence, if that makes sense. And that's kind of like what the composer does. He created this world and then determined, it's very Noah-ish. Like, this world's gone too far. There's no saving. Let's burn it down. Let's flood it.
Yeah.
And then even so, there's 3 weeks of this, and this is stretching it. I don't think they planned this far ahead, but you know, a lot of Christians believe in the Holy Trinity, the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, 3 weeks. I don't think that's correlated at all, but I find it kind of
funny. In the story
funny.
Of the game, that wasn't supposed to be 3 weeks. Neku keeps it going by asking and offering himself up to play again and again for higher stakes.
Oh, okay.
If I remember correctly, like, at the end of the first week, Shiki wins, and Neku is asked if he wants to play again, and then Shiki becomes his prize as his new most treasured thing, his friendship with Shiki. So he has to play again, and he has to win to bring Shiki back to life and give her another chance. So that adds a whole new layer of stakes. And then at the end of the second week, his partner Joshua sacrifices himself so Neku can keep going in a way.
Oh my God.
Which is a very Jesus allegory really, kind of thing.
Especially for what this is a huge grade S, for going by the racing ranks. Grade S spoiler.
Oh yeah.
Joshua is the composer. You find out the end of the
ringer.
Game.
Yeah.
And Neku is his, like, basically it's almost like the composer Joshua challenged the producer and the Reapers and everything to like try to do this, and I'm going to pick one person to try to save it. Like if you defeat him, then I destroy the world pretty much.
Basically Neku's his surrogate in the game. Like the composer says, who is Joshua says, all right, I want to get rid of this. If you can convince me, if you can get your players to overpower my surrogate player in this game, you can keep Shibuya, whatever. If my player wins, I win. Shibuya's gone. But Neku has no idea that's the case. He has no idea that his second partner
is just a pawn.
The composer. He has an idea. He gets flashbacks of his memories with Joshua. He thinks Joshua killed him. And he does, but it gets a little convoluted from there to explain. But
it wasn't that Joshua that killed him. It was one of the conductors that actually killed him. But since Joshua is kind of directing the conductors, it's kind of like he did kill. It's very strange.
I thought that the conductor for game 2 was trying to kill the composer. And then that was the memory that that Neku saw that was misinterpreted by him. And then after that, the composer shot Neku so he could be in the game and gave him a second player entry fee pin. So that's why Neku can keep going. He has 2 entry fee pins in the story. And when one of them gets destroyed, he still is allowed to play the game at the very end of the story there.
The story is just so complex.
It's very complex, but it's also much more sensible than Kingdom Hearts 2 through whatever.
Mm-hmm. Pretty much
it's
anything
very
after
easy
the,
to understand as
one.
You play it. Yeah.
Well, anything after Chain of Memories. Chain of Memories at least kind of makes sense because it's like a direct sequel, but that's neither here nor there.
Yeah.
So you find out that like the Composer is Joshua. The producer is this guy named Hanikawa, if I remember.
Yes, I can never remember his name. I think that's right.
But he's kind of like a shop owner. He's very affable. Like, he's just incredibly likable.
He's kind of like the watchman for the game to make sure people follow the rules.
Yeah.
In a sense. He's also, you find out through the secret reports, he was an angel of the composer, and he broke his rules to watch over the game and give Neku hints and stuff. He's not supposed to be doing what he's doing.
This is so freaking biblical. Like, the producer is Satan. Yeah. Joshua is, and if you're going with the Christian allegory of, like, the composer is God, right? And then Christians believe in the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Then Joshua sacrifices himself, which is Jesus, and Jesus is supposed to be is God at the same time. You know, this weird. I'm not going to try to justify the ridiculousness of my own religion.
Yeah. And even though when he does sacrifice himself, it's kind of like a fluke. Not a fluke, but it's very much intentional for Neku to see it and experience it to drive him further in the story. Because Joshua can't die. He's not really a mortal player. He takes a mortal body for that week of the game, but he's still the composer in the end.
Mm-hmm.
Which also goes for God taking a mortal body with Jesus and all that stuff. But there's a lot of religious allegories and metaphors in this game you could take out of it if you wanted to.
The end of the game is also super confusing because basically after you – the kind of surmise the plot so far, you know, Neku dies. He's part of the Reaper's game. You find out – you have a lot of really good interpersonal like stories between the different characters, between Shiki, between Beat and Rhyme and Neku and so on and so forth. And you, after you win after you survive all 7 days and like you win the game, pretty much the Reaper's game, then you start the second one. You know, you meet Joshua, he's your partner through this, and then you find out that, you know, like you said, at the beginning of the third, pretty much the third attempt is when you find out like Joshua's the composer. When you're in the third Reaper's game is when you find out Joshua's the composer. And you also find out that the one conductor is trying to actively plot against, like we were saying before, actively plot against the composer. And that's, what's the dude's name? Minamoto.
He's the conductor for the second week of the game. Yeah, he wants to overthrow everything and make it in his own way. He's crazy.
Yeah, he's nuts. His character is really fun, though. I really enjoy his character.
Yeah, he is a lot of fun.
After you defeat Minamoto, you basically... Joshua gives... Like, the composer, Joshua gives Neku one last challenge, and it's to... shoot Joshua to determine, like, basically determine the fate of Shibuya.
I think he has to kill me,
and you can save Shibuya, and he can't choose, so he gets shot by him. But then he wakes up in Scramble Crossing where the game starts, but he's alive this time,
and so all the players are too. Yeah,
and all the players are too. So it's very odd. So you don't really understand Joshua's motivation for. Mm-hmm. Doing this, you know, like you don't understand why he decided to do this for reasons. I genuinely don't know.
There's a little bit more in the ports and the bonus stuff they've added to other versions of the game, but honestly, they raise a lot more questions than answers that I think get answered a little bit more in the sequel, but I haven't played that yet, so I don't really know how to answer that.
Did you play the final remix version of this game? Because there's a remix of like it adds a new alternate ending.
It's like an extended ending. I played it on Android when it first got ported to that. They had this big countdown on the Square Enix site where the world ends with you thing. Everyone thought it was going to be a sequel. It was like a 5-day countdown. People were freaking out, and then surprise, you get an Android port. And I was like, oh, great, thanks. But I played that, and it kind of goes into that, this another day added on to the story, and you kind of see Joshua from another plane or another version of himself, and it does that. I'm trying to remember, but it adds more questions than answers, really.
Yeah, I'm still very confused by like what. I'm just confused.
The motivations. Because
you don't really understand why Joshua decides to just resurrect everybody and keep Shibuya there.
I think it was his final test for Neku. Like, say, do you really trust me or do you really want this? It's hard to say. I feel like people can have different interpretations and also be right.
I think that's a good, though, because it allows discussions like this. And it's been a minute since I didn't have as much time to research as I wanted to, but I did watch like basically plot synopsis videos. Now, there is like, you linked to me a while ago, there's a whole series on YouTube that is like hours and hours long devoted to breaking down the lore of this game, mm-hmm. the decisions and characters of this game, and it's incredibly interesting.
It's very comprehensive.
Could you talk a little bit about that? I understand, like, it's like I said, those videos are incredibly long, so I don't expect you to surmise all of that, trying to go over all that, but like, is there any way you could just kind of talk a little bit about some, like, what they go into in that series?
If it's the one I'm thinking about, they kind of take it from an academic literary approach, almost, about how the world works. And I haven't seen it in a long time, so I'm trying to remember. But they basically break down the motivations and the character. I can't really remember, honestly. I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. No, it's okay.
But it's the gaming professor or something like that.
I have the video. I was looking at it the other day. Let me find it again. I'm looking through my YouTube history, and it's filled with like a bunch of useless garbage, so I'm having a hard time. I watch them as random crap. It's filled with like hockey and John Oliver and what else do we got in here? Clips of Benedict Cumberbatch impersonating Alan Rickman. Oh, it's all over the place. It doesn't make any sense. I will try to find it, but it is really, truly fascinating. Like I watched like a chunk of it, and I can't remember what it is. I'm going to look for it. I'm going to look for it. The World Ends With You. It's Games as Literature.
That's what it's called.
Games as Literature. And the first, okay, I was wrong. It's not 4 hours, but it's a part one. And it's multiple parts, and the first part is 40 minutes. So if I look at the World Ends With You, it's a total of 6 videos. And the first 40 minutes, 15 minutes, 31, 24, 22, 36. It's a 6-part series all about breaking down the story of this game. So if you're curious, you can check out Games as Literature over on YouTube. And it will, one, spoil the game more than we have, and also break it down in a lot more eloquent ways than we have. Now, I think this would be a good time, though, to talk about some of the gameplay of this. We've talked a lot about the story, and we kind of glossed over the ending a little bit, but it's hard to describe the ending. It's pretty mm-hmm. much just,
and it's worth playing and reading and experiencing yourself for sure.
Even though we spoiled a lot, I don't think we gave away too much of the end. Like, we gave away a lot, don't get me wrong, but I feel like the ending...
There's still a lot to talk about, yeah.
Yeah, there's still a lot to the ending that we did not discuss, so definitely worth checking out. So, with the gameplay, we mentioned before, you have two screens. You're on mm-hmm. the DS. I haven't played on mobile / Android. Is it on Android and iPhone or just Android?
It's Android and iPhone, and there's a Switch port too, which has different methods of controlling for the Switch as well. But they're not fantastic.
Yeah, we both recommend playing the DS version of this game for mm-hmm. sure. The way it works, the RPG elements of this game are very unique because it's all based around pin collecting and fashion. So depending on the types of clothes you wear, like, and this is apparently like some, it's not realistic because it's a game, but like, this is apparently somewhat true, where like the fashion will change from district to district in Shibuya.
Yeah, Shibuya is like the fashion epicenter of Tokyo.
Mm-hmm.
In the real world.
Yeah, it's like the fashion center of Japan for that's for damn sure.
Yeah.
And but the fact like what like so there's different clothing brands and different styles, and what you wear gives you different boosts depending on what's trending in each mm-hmm. area of Shibuya. So ideally what you'd want to do is look on the map, see which brand is trending and have that in stock, like have that on your like in your backpack essentially, so you can just swap out real quick. Because there some brands will just have no effect, like you just do your normal amounts of damage. Other brands will do boosts. You can influence the brands in the different districts to like
that's so true. That yeah,
if you really
if you
want
do
to,
really you can, well, you can change the trends. Like if you yeah, fight if you, with like one brand really really well and exactly. really often in one area where it's the lower status, you can raise the status in that area.
So, exactly. So if you don't have any other options for clothes, if you kind of struggle bust your way through fighting all the noise in the area, then the more noise you defeat, the more you make the brand that you're wearing trend. And so when that happens, it just kind of it gives you that reward for kind of struggling through. Mm-hmm. Then you get bonuses for wearing brands that are popular in that area. So
if you find something you like, you can stick with it too. If like say one brand has things you don't want to play with, you can still make it work doing with what you want. It'll just take time to evolve that area.
Exactly. And you can then you also collect pins, and the pins, what is the term for the powers in this? I'm blanking on this. Do you remember what they're called?
Psychokinetic or something like that? I forget.
Yeah, some psycho. I was going to say psychosis, but that's not what it is.
Because there's different pins. There's all sorts of ways you can use. You can tap the pen. You can shout at your DS. You can scratch at it. You can
shout at your DS? I didn't know.
There's a few pins that if you yell, it'll activate the pin with the microphone on the DS.
Wow. I'm
pretty sure, at least. I never use them because I play games in public. So, you know, I don't want to be like screaming in public at a machine and on the train or the bus and have people freak out.
I remember I was on a missions trip and I was playing Legend of Zelda Phantom Hourglass. And there's a scene, I might have told this, I'm pretty sure I've told the story before on the podcast, but it's worth repeating. There is a segment where you speak to a vendor and he wants you to shout for a good deal. So you have to yell into the microphone in order, and the louder you yell, the more of the discount you'll get. Now, I was on an airplane when I was playing this game, so I couldn't do that. So I was trying to figure a way around it. So I like took my finger and I put it over the microphone, like at the center of the DS, and I just went like just rubbed it real fast back and forth. and it worked. I got a really it worked for that. So they gave me a really good discount, and then the guy goes, "Oh, good job on, you know, yelling for this discount. I hope you weren't actually yelling. You know, you could probably just clap into the microphone. You'd look really silly if you were just yelling." And I'm like, you son of a bitch. You're trolling me. This game That's is trying funny. To get me in trouble. It was really funny, though. But yeah, so you get different pins. And I didn't. That's why I was so surprised. I didn't know you could shout. But they give you different powers. And the amount of creativity that they showed in these pin designs is incredible. Like you're saying, some pins have you tap the touchscreen and wherever you tap, it does a bit of damage. Some of them you have to slash across the screen, but it even depends on what you slash on. Some of them make you draw a slash through Neku. Others just make you draw a slash anywhere else on the touchscreen. Others, you draw a circle around it, or you might have to draw a triangle or something along those lines.
It affects that space. There's all sorts of ways you can interact with this game.
Exactly. Some of them, they will only, it doesn't do any damage to enemies, but it interacts with the objects in the space. So, if you draw a line across, a barricade, it'll launch the barricade into the enemy. Mm-hmm. Stuff like that. It's super inventive. The amount of stuff they were able to figure out to do, create to do with a limited moveset as a touchscreen is honestly impressive. And I'm not saying that as a negative thing, because you could technically draw whatever you want on the touchscreen, but this is a pretty
it feels really varied.
It's varied, and it's a very frenetic type of action RPG. It's very chaotic. And so to do that, you can't tell the player to input commands with the stylus that would take a long amount of time. It has to be quick, a quick circle, draw lines, stab the screen. Yeah. You know, they had to find unique ways for the players to use the stylus in a very quick and fast way that was also easy to do and easy to understand. And that, to me, was impressive.
And it works. Like, nothing really... Sometimes when you want to use a touchscreen doing a lot of things at once on the DS, it'll kind of interfere with other mechanics, but nothing ever feels broken when you play it like that.
What were some of your favorite pins in the game?
I like the projectile ones where you shoot bullets just by tapping in different areas, and I liked the one of the first ones you get is a pyrokinetic, like a fire one.
Mm-hmm.
And if you level that pin up by experience or even not playing the game, that's, I forgot about that. You can, if you put your game in sleep mode or shut it off for a while, you'll get experience for some things by not playing the game and taking a break.
It's just really cool.
And some pins can level up that way too.
And the fire pin, I think.
Yeah, a lot of them do. The fire pin, you'll just slowly drag the pen across the screen, and it'll leave a trail of fire, and you can burn up a lot of things at once like that. And I like, there's so many of them. There's not really a wrong way to play this game.
That's a beautiful thing about it. Now, you only have a certain number of slots for pins to choose. I believe you start out with, like, what, four?
Three or four, and you get six total.
Yeah, you get, as the game goes on, you get more. There's one slot if, like, you want to heal, that's a slot that you have to choose. There's a pin that lets you heal. And even then, you can only do it, I think, like three times over the course of that one battle. Yep. So you have to make sure that you are using it sparingly. And I think it starts out, you can only use it once. But as you level it up, then you can use it more than once.
That's correct. Something
like that. Then you also have, besides the pins and besides the fashion, there's also like food that will increase your stats, if I remember correctly. Like, mm-hmm.
You can digest food over time. Like,
yes.
Neku will eat a hot dog, and it'll say this takes six battles to come eat this hot dog. And then once you do, you'll get the strength and the intelligence or whatever boost that the hot dog will provide. But it takes like six battles for it to take into effect or something.
That's what it is. Yeah. Cause then you get a permanent stat boost after that?
I think so. Yeah.
It just like you said, it takes some time. So like the better the food, the longer it takes for you mm-hmm. to digest it. And the longer it takes to digest, then the better stats you get, which is kind of a cool mechanic. It really felt like for me by the end of the game, it had really opened up because I didn't touch the food mechanic at all, even though it's introduced fairly early on. It's either midway through or slightly before the midpoint. And then they introduce it, and it really opens. Like, once I kind of learned, like, oh, this is what the food thing does. Oh
yeah.
And then it really, like, you can do so many cool things with it.
Yeah. Like, there's so many different people. I could play this game one way. You can play this game one way. You'd have the same story experience, have a very different player experience.
Extremely different. I think that's what I love about it, though. Like, it's such a unique RPG because it's not even just like a normal action RPG. Like,
yeah,
because your abilities are based off of pins. They kind of treat you a bit as a Pokemon where you only have a certain number of abilities you can choose from. Now, unlike Pokemon, you can hot swap out those abilities. Like, you can, and what is cool though is if you level up a pin all the way, it will quote unquote like give birth to another pin, and it will just repeat the same pin over again. The reason that's important is because you can trade pins for money, mm-hmm. so it's a way to kind of give you more money to spend on new clothes.
And
it also can then if you there's like. Not every pin is created the same. Just because one pin does the same attack, not every pin will, like, certain pins will allow you to evolve them into a better form of them. And so say you have like five pins that all do the same. They're the exact same pin in terms of ability, but all five do slash, but not all five will let you evolve that pin into the next level, next version of slash. Mm-hmm. At least not that I found. Cause there were sometimes there, that would happen. I could evolve some and others that I couldn't.
Yeah. Based definitely like sometimes like, oh, you can slash three times and have less damage, or it'll evolve into a slash plus two, or there's different variations depending on how cheap the pin is and how easy to get it and how you use it.
It's there's just a lot, like you were saying before, there's just so much variation, and the way you play it would be so different than the way I would play it. And it really is just really well designed, where like there is no wrong way. They do give, I believe I remember they give you, they do challenge you sometimes where they will take away types of pins or specific pins that you can't use for specific fights. So you have to like kind of, you do, it forces you to branch out and try a lot of different pins. So even if you aren't proficient in some of them and you don't like them, you better have leveled it up at least a little bit so you can at least understand how it works. And so, even take out the understanding part, at least it's powerful enough that you can do some bit of damage.
It wants you to be familiar, but it won't force you to play a specific way either.
Exactly. It makes you branch out, but it won't force you to stick to that new way. Just, it's kind of, it's almost like a, how it's like a, it's just a little like a health check. It's like, let's see where you're at. Let's see how well you know this game. I don't necessarily think it completely works. Like I don't mind that they do it, because I liked learning about different pins, but at the same time, like it's a smart game design choice because it forces the players to try new things. But at the same time, it kind of forcing the players to do something they shouldn't have to do. Like there's an interesting thing that I remember learning about in game design, where it's like, once a player learns an effective strategy that applies to the most broad situation, the player, not the game developer, the player makes the game boring. They will, because every player, I don't care, most, I shouldn't say every player, most players will then just be like, well, this works and it's easy to do, so I'm just going to stick with this until it doesn't work anymore. And that's not a real, and I'm saying this as someone who literally does this all the time. It is not really a good way to play a game, because you're really limiting yourself, to what the game has to offer. You're choosing to play the most narrowly focused version of that game possible, because that's what you're comfortable with. And I understand that, but at the same time, there's a lot more out there. So I respect games that are able to find a balance where it's like, no, you need to try something new here. You need to kind of branch out and try something different. You don't have to be an expert in it, but you have to try it.
Yeah.
And who knows, maybe you'll like it. If not, then we're not going to make you do it again.
And luckily those points don't come up too often, and not very crucial parts in the game either.
Yes, it's not like it's a big boss or something like that. It's usually like a
get through the store, try this. It's like a,
it's like a little side quest almost.
Mm-hmm.
So that's pretty much like what the overall gameplay mechanics are like. You know, you collect pins that give you different powers. We didn't really talk about the stuff that's happening on the top half of the screen. Like we said, this game's combat is on two screens. Mike, how would you describe the top half of the screen? Like, how does that mechanic work?
It's kind of like an input chain, and different partners control differently, and they have different combos you can acquire. Like, Shiki's is patterns on cards, so you go up, down, left, and right. You know, you try to make it through. There'll be like branching paths in a chain, and sometimes it'll break off faster than other ones. You want to go as far along as you can, and that combo chain is directing you towards. And for her, you want to get 3 matching cards on the end of those chains. And if you do that, you get a team attack that's extra powerful. And with Joshua, mm-hmm. there's number cards. You want to get the higher or lower version for the next number. And I forget what beats is. It's a little different. But basically, you want to follow a path of button inputs to a desirable point for a combo, kind of.
And while some people do find all those different ways to play on the top screen difficult, it's not nearly as bad as it seems. And like you were saying earlier, Mike, you can turn on the computer, the AI basically, to automatically play on the top screen if you so choose. Mm-hmm. If you want the challenge of doing it, of playing the top and bottom at the same time, then you can. But I really think it was a cool idea to try that. I can't think of other games that like, I think Nintendo does this right, and this, I know this is Square Enix that developed this, Square Enix in connection with Jupiter. And you know what? Something I always say at the beginning, and I forgot to do this time, when this game actually even came out. We were talking off mic. This is the 15th anniversary of the Japanese release of this game. We'll get just to read off these release dates real quick. July 27th, 2007 is when this game came out in Japan. So we're, this is coming out in late May. So this is not close to that date, but we're getting close to the 15th anniversary of when it came out. And then the North American release was on April 22nd, 2008. But so anyway, I digress. So even, but yeah, so even though Square Enix and Jupiter developed this game, I think Nintendo is one of the only game console manufacturers and game developers and publishers that consistently find a way to push the medium forward. Not always in the direction, the correct direction, but they're always trying something different. And it's because they're constantly changing the form factor. Like, I love my PS, my PlayStations and my Xboxes, but like, realistically, what has those consoles done to push the medium forward other than graphically?
Yeah.
They're like, and I would say they've made consoles much more ubiquitous in terms of like the, like, you know, my wife knows how to use a console even though she's not a gamer because she watches Netflix on it and stuff like that. So they've made it a lot more user friendly. Like they've branched out from just games with it. But Nintendo, like, you look at all of their consoles and they have constantly tried to find a way to make people play games in ways they have not played them before. You look at the Wii and the motion controls, not saying that was smart, because I don't get me wrong, the motion controls were great for what they were, but yeah. Too often it's one of those things where, you know, like, oh no, you need a motion control in this game. Like, well, this game doesn't lend itself to motion control, but the truly good games on Nintendo systems usually utilize the functionality, like the gimmick functionality, the quote-unquote gimmick functionality of that hardware. And the dual screens on the DSs with the touchscreen and the secondary non-touchscreen on the top, this game is perfectly utilized for it. And this is an example of like truly innovative gameplay that I really feel like pushed the medium forward, and maybe just because it was so different and so unique. And I wish more consoles would do stuff like this. Not necessarily the DS was like a, kind of a gamble, because like two screens, like that's kind of strange, mm-hmm. but like it worked really well. I mean, the DS is the second best selling console of all time behind the PS2. If you look at like sales numbers, it's crazy.
Yeah, it was very successful.
Yeah. And Nintendo's still doing it. Like, you look at the Switch and it's like there's not a whole lot of stuff they can do in terms of like weird form factor for it. Like, there's nothing really like that's true. I mean, the Joy-Cons are actually pretty unique just because you can have it's a lot easier for multiplayer.
Yeah. And there's some motion control stuff for some games, but it's not dominating the game itself.
I think Nintendo has found the right balance of like, here's a console with motion controls, but we're not going to make you use the motion controls for everything.
Yeah.
We're going to have some games that are like really good for another game. Just thinking of consoles with like that have really good, like form, like that really try to do something different with the form, the Vita, you ever play Tearaway?
I have. That's a great game.
It's a very good game and no one talks about it. No one talks about that game, and it's such a brilliant game. And like what Media Molecule did with that game, where like they did with it's the only Vita game that I can legitimately say that I've played. I'm sure there's another one out there that I've never heard of before, but that used the back touchpad perfectly.
Yeah, it used every part of that system to its full advantage.
Exactly. And I feel like to bring my long-winded rant back to The World Ends With You, I feel like Square did that with this game. Like, I really feel like they took everything that was cool about the DS and found a way to make an action RPG out of it.
Absolutely. They really did.
So before we wrap up, I want to talk about just briefly about the music. The music in this game is
so good.
Incredible. It's so good. The composer is Takeharu Ishimoto. He incorporated a lot of different genres in this. You have rock, you have hip hop, you have electronica and techno, you have J-pop, you have like all of these influences. And I still get like the Shibuya Crossing, like the na 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 na. I don't know. That's an awful rendition of it.
Just for an example of that, my text tone is the far, as the first part of the song Twister in the game. It's da-la-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na. That was my text tone on my phone for like 5 years. And if you follow me on Twitch, when I get a new follower, it makes that noise too. It's just so it's just the soundtrack fits the game so well, and it's so varied and it's so good. I have it on iTunes. I like it so much.
It's such a good soundtrack, and like it, I miss the game. It's so hard now to find games like legitimately great soundtracks because so many games go for atmosphere more than like something memorable. And that's not a knock against it. I'm not complaining about that. I understand why they're doing it. They're doing it to build atmosphere more than to build memory. Like you remember more about the gameplay than you do about, like, I love Horizon Zero Dawn and God of War. I can't tell you about the music in those games.
Yeah.
I don't remember them at all, but I remember how those games made me feel, and the music definitely helped with that. These games, the music is perfect for it. Like it's so good. I didn't really have much else to say about the music. I'm not a musician, so I can't really break down like the tracks of it. But do you have any other final words on the music?
I would just say that to tackle so many different genres and so many different takes on those genres, like there's different types of electronica, different types of J-rock and J-pop, and different levels of like hip-hop. I don't know how to say it, but
different versions of hip. Yeah.
They nail each genre equally well. It's not like, oh God, there's a rap song, I got to skip past this really fast. It's like, no, they're all equally good.
It works really well throughout the entire. Yeah, the whole thing just works on every level.
Yeah.
Now, to wrap this all up, I wanted to kind of talk briefly about the different versions of this game. We referenced before, there's three different versions of this. There's the original DS, there is the mobile port, and then there's the Nintendo Switch port. Mike and I both agree you should play the DS version if you're able to, but I have not played the mobile or the Switch version. Have you played those versions?
I have, yeah. I have all three versions of this game.
Which one would you suggest if they can't get the DS one?
The Switch port is more or less a port of the mobile version, because in that one, you don't really bother with the top screen character at all. You can kind of get them as like a bonus pin if you do really well. Basically, okay. They become another pin you can attack with. And the way that it works on Switch is, in handheld mode, it plays exactly like the mobile phone version. But if you use the Joy-Cons, it's like a motion control version, and they just couldn't nail the motions right. It's not very good motion control. If you play, I'd recommend the Switch version in handheld mode anytime to try. If you're not sure about getting it on DS, it's still worth it that way. But the Joy-Cons, like the sensor gets off center, and it kind of misses input sometimes. And if you can play two players, so one person will play as Neku, one person will play as Shiki, for example, with different Joy-Cons, or you can play it that way together, but it just can't keep up with the variety of motions and keeping the cursor centered on screen. You have to constantly tap the button to recenter the cursor. It's just, maybe they patched it since I played it, but I played it for like a few hours and just abandoned it, playing it that way. It's a shame. But if you want to play it handheld, it plays pretty much like you'd expect.
Well, there you go. That's for those who have not played it. That's the easiest way probably to get it is the Switch version. If you prefer mobile, I mean, yeah, by all means, it's what's available. We both recommend the DS version if you're able to, just because it really, like we said, it's designed around the DS's mechanic, like the DS's abilities, the touch, the dual screens, a touch screen. And I really feel like that makes the game's experience that much better. Now, I will say it is a little hard to play if you don't have it like set down on the table at times. Like you kind of have to hold it with one hand and mm-hmm. use the stylus on the with the other. And you're tapping the screen while holding it up and it's like bouncing off the stylus. And you still have to hit the button, but it's like, or sorry, the D-pad to like make the top screen stuff go. And it could be hard to do. But
you
have to have a good grip. It's a lot easier if you have it on a table, but you can, it's 100% doable even off that. And like, I'm not even going to say your hand might cramp up, but I never, for something that you would think would be super uncomfortable, it didn't happen to me as often as I thought it would.
No, I agree. Describing it, you can see how people would think that it would get uncomfortable over time. And I played this game on like a 4-hour flight all the way through, and it didn't bother me at all.
Yeah, it's not as bad as you think it would be. And that's kind of nice, actually. One thing I forgot to mention about the gameplay, just in thinking of the dual screens, what you do with the different, like when you, if you can land, if you land combos on alternating screens, they bounce this ball back and forth. And it essentially, it gives it, I forget exactly what the ball does. I think it helps with your power ups or something like that.
It makes you more consistently powerful. Yeah.
Yeah. So every time you're able to bounce the ball to the screen above you or below you, like bouncing back and forth to the screen, you get more powerful. But you have to complete a combo in order to do that. So you have to complete a combo on the bottom screen, launches the ball up to the top screen. You complete a combo on the top screen, launches the ball back down to the bottom screen. So realistically, the game is meant to be played with you just prioritizing one screen at a time, like focusing on the combo mm-hmm. at the top, moving it down, focusing the combo on the bottom. Stuff like that. So
it definitely rewards consistency.
I was bad at that. I was always really bad at it.
Yeah.
I don't really have too much more to say about this. Mike, any final thoughts before we give our final ratings? By ratings, I mean just telling people if they should still play it. But any final thoughts on the game? Anything that you want to talk about that I did not bring up or we forgot to bring up?
I'd say that people sometimes for the first, because I guess we said the game, it's three Reapers games throughout the world with you. Each one is a week. Some people play like halfway through the first week and be like, oh, Neku's annoying. He's never going to change. He's going to be this whiny brat forever. And they give up on the game before they even make it to the end of the first week. If you find him annoying at first, just power through those first couple of days and he'll grow a lot on you.
And you're going to hate Joshua even more during the second week. Yeah, let me tell you, he's a bitch. And I say this as a Josh.
That's true.
He's not fun to deal with, but he's an interesting character nonetheless. Yeah. And for me overall, I would just say play this game. It's truly one of the most unique game experiences I've ever had, and that's hard to find in general. I'm not even just saying that because it's an older, people know I love retro games, and I guess you could consider this retro in a weird sense. It kind of is because it's almost
it's
15 years
there,
old.
Yeah.
I mean, some people kind of give the 10-year mark. Like anything older than 10 years, it's retro now because it's like that's one or two generations ago. Like if you look at 10 years ago from now, you're looking at 2012, which is like that's the year PS4 came out technically, which is weird to think because that was a long generation.
Yeah. My mark for retro personally is when did it come out and how long did it last? Like the Dreamcast came out in 99, only lasted a couple years. So it's more retro than the PS2 because that lasted forever. There were PS2 games up until like 2010. They're both retro now to me, but
there were PS2 games up to like 2012 and 13, actually.
Yeah,
like
exactly.
Some of the last games were like Pro Evolution Soccer from Konami and stuff like that.
Yeah. But I'd say even for an older, it doesn't feel like an old DS game. It doesn't feel clunkier. Dated, it feels a little dated in terms of the fashion and the art, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
But there's nothing that could stop this game from appealing to someone who's 17 today or was 17 in 2007.
I would agree. And if you still feel that the urge to play as an angsty teenager, this game is for you because Neku is one hell of an angsty teenager. But no, it's worth it, 100% worth it. Like, it's just so unique, it's so original. I've never played a game like it or since, and I would love to. It's kind of why I want like a weird form factor like the DS is, like with a stylus and like all this other stuff. Like,
I know what you mean.
I want something like that again because you get unique experiences. I haven't bought one, but that's why I want to get a play date because play dates are like it's truly, truly unique with the little hand crank on the side. Not every game utilizes it. I was listening to the newest episode of the CU podcast today, and it came out last night, but this is kind of setting it at a specific date and time for those who listen to that. But Ian had just gotten his play date in the mail, and he was talking about all the different games for it. I'm just like, it's cool. It's a unique way to play these little types of micro games. I really feel like that's one of the things that's kind of missing from like I really think you need another handheld like form factor, like something that's for smaller experiences, something that you don't need. Now the Switch is nice because you can get both. You can get those small handheld experiences and those large, like gigantic, you know, console experiences on it. But I still feel like there's just something nice about having something that requires you to play games in a way that's different than the way you have before. And I mean physically different, whether it's like a Playdate where it's a hand crank or whether it's a DS with a touchscreen or what, or the Wii with the Wii motion controls. Like I feel like there needs to be more, something else out there, whether it's Nintendo, Sony, Microsoft, whomever who does it. I really would love to see something else like that out there. I don't know if it would succeed in today's market.
It's hard to say, but I feel like those experiences are going to be missed going forward.
Yeah, I would agree. So let's wrap this all up. Mike, thank you so much for joining me. This was a really fun discussion on The World Ends With You. Where can everybody find you online? And is there anything you'd like to promote?
On Twitter, I'm MikeKeke352, MikeKeke352. I'm also on Twitch. I stream a couple times a week, usually. And my YouTube channel is called Forever Loading. I have a series on there about the games of working designs, and I'm working on a series on how the Sega Saturn could have been salvaged in the US. I have a new video on that in the works. It should come out in a couple months or so. So hopefully if you want to find more of what I talk about, you can check stuff out there.
All right. And then as usual for me, you can follow me on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at StillLoadingPod on all of them. If you want to email me, you can email me stillloadingcontact@gmail.com. If you want to support the show, you can do so in a number of ways. You can give it a 5-star rating review on Apple Podcasts. That helps more people find the show, and it makes me feel warm and fuzzy, which is always nice. You can also support it monetarily if you go to patreon.com/stillloadingpod. For just $1 a month, you'll get all the episodes at a higher bitrate and a couple days early. At the time of this recording, the episode that just actually... Never mind. The episode that you would have already heard that episode by the time this one comes out. So never mind. But I do have to record a bonus episode for this Friday, which who knows if I'll get around to this weekend. I have a busy weekend ahead of me, so we'll see. I need to find some way to do it. But there is for the $5 tier, there are two bonus episodes. So you know what? This is a bad plug. Let me start this over real fast. For $1 a month, episodes a few days early at a higher bit rate and access to a patron exclusive Discord. Done. For $5 a month, you get all that plus two bonus episodes a month. So if that sounds interesting to you, go to patreon.com/stillloadingpod. But a better place to spend your money, your hard-earned dollars, is the Bit by Bit Foundation. The Bit by Bit Foundation is a nonprofit organization whose mission is to put video games and video game consoles in the hands of kids receiving inpatient care at hospitals. So if you want to support them, go to bitbybitfoundation.org and consider donating. That is all I have for you on this episode of Still Loading. Mike, thank you once again for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
And I will see you all next time.